On February 3rd, 2005, Matilda, aka Matt Bernstein Sycamore, spoke at Bookshop Santa Cruz. Matilda is the editor of a 37-author anthology called That's Revolting: Queer Strategies for Resisting Assimilation. Matilda spoke on a variety of topics, including gay marriage and assimilation, challenging power, and the rejection of queer youth from established gay districts such as the Castro in San Francisco. I began recording as Matilda was talking about a recent book reading in Atlanta, Georgia.
There was a table, this is in early November, there was a table of Christmas decorations. So we had the American flag, we had, you know, Christian, you know, wonderful decorations in case we went to buy them early. And then the reading was really interesting because there were three different audiences. So in the front, we had the audience that had come, you know, specifically for the reading. And they were sort of politicized about radical queer issues and anti-assimilationist politics. And then in the back, there was this audience of, you know, mostly gay men who were kind of like a little confused, you know, what was going on in this gay bookstore, you know? And there were kind of, you know, there were certain moments, like when I introduced, you know, gay marriage, you know, people in the audience in the back, they were like, yay! And I was like, I don't think so. Not at this reading here tonight. And then there was a third audience, interestingly enough, who was sort of younger, kind of trendier, queers who were outside smoking and staring in the window. And I couldn't figure out the whole time why these people, you know, they were kind of looking. The window was like over here to the side, and they were staring in the window, and I was like, what are they doing? And then afterwards, I found out that the reading was being broadcast on speakers outside the store onto the sidewalk.
Wow.
So, and that was an interesting reading because people were really loud and sort of combative and had interesting conversations with one another. So feel free tonight to be loud as well. I always welcome, you know, the feedback. And the question and answer section is always a nice spot for, you know, delicious, devastating drama, in other words. So, and so 2 days after Atlanta, I was traveling with two other contributors to the book. We were driving through the South. And 2 days later, after this sort of very fancy gay bookstore, it had a special little lounge with leather cushioned seats, you know, for the reading. We were reading at this space in New Orleans called Noe Miasto, which is sort of an anarchist performance and living space. And it's in this old warehouse, and they've built the second floor, so it's kind of like at a tilt. You know, you sort of walk up, down the hall, and then you kind of go down this way a little bit and down that way. And so it was a little bit of a different atmosphere, and you know, it's a little bit run down, and it was an interesting reading because, you know, it's mostly a straight space. And so the audience, there were a lot of queers there, but there were also a lot of sort of straight, lefty, sort of anarchist-leaning people who are really kind of excited about the politics of the book, you know, excited about talking about issues from a radical queer perspective, and also being radical and queer and not having to sort of silence queer parts, you know, of our identities in order to participate in other sort of struggles, you know, quote, other struggles. So that was a fun reading. And then that night, we drove overnight to get to Austin, Texas. And we arrived at Austin after driving through the night at about 10 in the morning, went to sleep, and woke up just before the reading. So we had, you know, the 10 to 6 schedule, you know, which is a good schedule for sleeping, I think. And we were a little bit sketchy, you know, the reading in Austin was at a store very similar, actually, to Bookshop Santa Cruz. It's called Book People. It's a large independent bookstore. And we were a little late to the reading, so we were really excited. The audience was great, you know, really supportive and really loud and really energetic. And at Book People, they have sort of like a separate reading room. And at the end of the reading, they were like sort of, you know, wanting us to leave the room really quickly. And so we're like, well, what's going on? Because the store wasn't closing, and the reading was packed. But they said, oh, well, you know, this room is owned by Whole Foods, you know, which was next door. And they just used the room for the reading. And so we found out later that they use that room for certain readings, you know, the queer readings, you know, the controversial readings, but that the rest of the readings happened, you know, in the center of the store. So I'm glad to see that tonight we aren't in, you know, in a little room owned by Whole Foods. And they were able to be here in the center of the store. And so for this reading, you know, I like to be very up to date on my introduction. So I thought I'd look at a little bit of, you know, sort of the gay media and see what was kind of going on. And so found some things. I live in San Francisco, and there's this radio program on one of the public radio stations in San Francisco, KUOW. And it's called Out in the Bay, and I've never actually heard this program because it's on for 15 minutes a week. So it's between 7:45 and 8 p.m. on Thursdays. And just recently, I got inside my house, you know, and I realized at 7:45 p.m. I can figure out what's on Out in the Bay, right? So I turned it on, and there was this amazing show about, it was talking about the potential of gay marriage, you know, to redefine gender roles, right? So they said, you know, with the gay people, you know, gay marriage, like, who is the man, you know, and who is the woman? And they said, you know, the stay-at-home gay dad has just as much of a problem staying at home as the heterosexual stay-at-home dad, you know. And conversely, they said, you know, the lesbian provider, you know, has just as much of a problem providing, you know, taking on that unconventional gender performance, you know, as, you know, the straight woman who has to provide for her kids. So this was 15 minutes of this. Then we had the National Gay Program. And what I found on the National Gay Program was all about marriage. And they also talked about how there was this man, you know, in the south of India who, he survived the tsunami, this Hollywood executive. And he was able to grab onto a telephone pole and hold himself there in the wind. So, you know, never mind, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people who died in South and Southeast Asia. This Hollywood executive, this white gay man, he managed to survive that tsunami. Oh, just amazing. And then they were like, oh, yeah, and by the way, you know, let's talk about queers, you know, who also were affected by the tsunami in Southeast Asia. So, you know, it was a little bit of information in there. I was like, oh, okay, well, let's see. And then, you know, I took a look at the gay papers in San Francisco, and more tsunami coverage. So in the BAR, the Bay Area Reporter, on the cover of the BAR, there were two lesbians who survived the tsunami as well. Wow, and so, you know, we have a picture of smiling white lesbians. And they were in the south of Thailand, actually, and they didn't like the, you know, the house that they had rented. It was kind of tacky. So they left. They didn't actually get a refund, but they left, and they ended up, I mean, who knew? The tsunami hit, and they survived. So all these gay people surviving the tsunami. Then I looked at the Bay Times, the other gay paper in San Francisco, and I found out about this amazing document. You know, it's this document authored by the Gay Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, and signed by 22 national gay organizations. So pretty much all of the national gay organizations. Human Rights Campaign, National Gay Lesbian Task Force, Lambda Legal, Marriage Equality, all those people. Oh, we just love them. They do such great work. So this amazing document of consensus, you know, in the LGBT community. It's called Civil Rights Community Movement. So it's very catchy. And I printed it out. And I found, you know, in the very first sentence, actually just before the first sentence, they have some definitions. So they want to tell us, you know, what is civil rights community movement? We have to define these terms, right? So civil rights, it's very interesting. In the very first sentence, they say the rights belonging to an individual by virtue of citizenship. So in the very first clause, we see who is already excluded, you know, from this movement, talking about inclusion. Oh, no one only people who are citizens, you know, are allowed to be part of this movement. So already, in the very first clause, you see the discrimination that's inherent in this, you know, mainstream LGBT movement that is supposedly about inclusion. And so there's some great, I really encourage everyone to read this amazing document, but there's another really good moment. There are actually several, but there's this one part where they talk about opening America's eyes to the true family values, and then they talk about all of us, right? LGBT couples, parents, and families are living and demonstrating every day. So I was thinking, like, well, how many people in the room tonight are in LGBT couples, parents, or families? Do we have people here? LGBT couples, parents?
Well, couples.
Let's see, there's one. Okay, so I guess Maybe you're not. So let's see. So maybe do we think this document is speaking for us? If there's a couple people here, maybe fit into this category. And we can see once again sort of the agenda of discrimination and this sort of like redefining what it means to be queer. What does it mean to be queer? It means you can be in a couple, a parent, or a family. You know what I mean? It's, and no one else is included. So I like to start, you know, I have lots of anecdotes. So another anecdote I have. This one is about an event called Reclaim the Commons. And Reclaim the Commons happened about a year ago in San Francisco. And it was this attempt to confront and shut down this biotechnology conference that was happening at Moscone Center in San Francisco. And it was sort of modeled after the WTO protests in Seattle, but not nearly as well attended or as successful. And at the beginning of one of the first demonstrations as part of the Reclaim the Commons, this speaker concluded, you know, one of those sort of standard tirades against globalization, you know, somewhat effective, but not entirely interesting. And they said, you know, they said, even if our numbers on this day were small, this was the beginning of the movement. And according to this person, things start in San Francisco. Now, never mind for a second that this demonstration in question was more of a hippie be-in than any sort of challenge to globalization. When someone says things start in San Francisco, you know, I get a little scared. And so I was thinking about it. I was like, okay, what started in San Francisco? Let's see. Rice-A-Roni. Let's see. Wells Fargo Bank. And so, you know, I was paying extra close attention as this presumably straight speaker concluded to a round of applause, you know, from an almost entirely straight audience at this protest against globalization. And what do you think they said started in San Francisco? Gay marriage! See? Oh, so exciting. So, if this speaker were paying attention at this protest against globalization, they would notice that gay marriage is the ultimate genetically modified organism. So think about it. It combines violent strains of nationalism, patriotism, consumerism, and patriarchy, and then delivers them into one deadly product. So gay marriage proponents are anxious to discard all those tacky hues of lavender and pink, right? Those are yesterday's colors. In favor of what we saw at, you know, the gay bookstore in Atlanta, the good old stars and stripes. So literally, at every pro-marriage demonstration, gay marriage proponents drape themselves in old glory as the U.S. bombs away. And let me quote from a promotional email for this amazing event happening in New York City and then later on in Washington, D.C., and it was a benefit for marriage equality called Wed Rock. That's right, Wed Rock. And it starred numerous straight and gay celebrities, major label activist rockers from Bob Mould to Slater Kinney, Moby to La Tigra. And the end of the email, you know, just to get everyone all excited about gay marriage, what did they say? They said, get angry. Protect your citizenship. So if gay marriage is about protecting citizenship, then whose citizenship is being protected? Most people who grow up in this country who aren't born rich, straight, white, and male aren't born full citizens. So gay marriage proponents would like us to think that full citizenship means attaining things like tax breaks and inheritance rights. And this is part of the larger picture of assimilation. As the issues I like to call the Holy Trinity, we've got marriage, military service, and adoption, have become the central preoccupation of a gay movement more centered around obtaining straight privilege than challenging power. And since I'm talking about the Holy Trinity, you know, I don't want to leave out that all-important issue we've all been really waiting for, you know. You know, I was in New England recently, too, and ordination into the priesthood, right? Woo! We just can't wait. So, maybe, just maybe, you know, for rich white gay people with things like beach condos and, you know, a really nice stock portfolio with a couple hedge funds that need trimming every now and then. Maybe, you know, for these people, gay marriage, you know, it's that one thing standing in the way of full citizenship. But what about for everyone else? And so we don't have to look far to see more examples of the twisted priorities of this gay mainstream. So nationwide, we can see the creation of these gay business improvement districts or neighborhood beautification projects. And what do they generally mean? It means get rid of the people of color, get rid of the trannies, get rid of the whores, get rid of the homeless people, and then we can have this beautiful white Gaylandia, you know, this amazing place to shop and buy cocktails. It's just great. You know, you can really be yourself by drinking all that Budweiser. That's the low end. You know, if you're really, you know, successful, you have a couple Grey Goose Cosmotinis after work. And so, you know, I've been on tour for a while, and I thought, well, San Francisco is this great place to come back to, you know, as this example of what happens when, you know, gay assimilationists succeed at their goals, right? So they become part of the power structure. And we can look to the Castro district in San Francisco, sort of the gay Mecca, and we see, you know, just a few years ago, wealthy gay residents who fought against the construction of a queer youth shelter. So what did they say? They said, it's gonna get in the way of community property values. So, what kind of community is being created when property values are more important than people's lives? So, we have queers from all over the country escaping really scary families of origin, places where they couldn't express their gender, sexual, social identities, coming to San Francisco as the safe space, you know, this gay Mecca. And what do gay people who made that same journey, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, what do? They're like, oh no, they're like not in this neighborhood. You're not contributing to the neighborhood economy. You know, that's the whole rhetoric. It's like, you're not shopping at Diesel or the Pottery Barn. We don't see you in the bars. You can't even get into the bars. So, you know, nowhere is the tyranny of assimilation more evident than in the way that the borders are policed. And I'll give another example from San Francisco, and this involves the illustrious Gavin Newsom, who has since, you know, catapulted to national fame. But this was before he was elected mayor, and one of the other successes, you know, of gay assimilationists in San Francisco is that you can't win an election, right, without pandering to the gay vote. So Gavin Newsom's first gesture, you know, as this mayoral candidate, facing an election against two gay candidates, was to hold this lavish fundraiser at the LGBT Center. And it was called Hot Pink, and it was $120 a plate. And this is at the same time, you know, Gavin Newsom's claim to fame at this point was this amazing ballot measure in San Francisco called Care Not Cash. And so what did Care Not Cash do? It took away homeless people's welfare benefits, and it replaced them with care. So, you know, part of the, you know, the standard picture of ruling class straight conservatives to criminalize the most vulnerable people in order to get ahead at the polls. And so protesters arrived at the center, and we were there to confront Newsom on his blatant racist, classist agenda and to call attention to the center's hypocrisy for welcoming Newsom instead of challenging that same agenda. So our question was, whose center is this? Right? Is it a center for, you know, a straight ruling class conservative politician? Or, you know, this is the LGBT center, right? Or is it a center for marginalized queers? You know, queers of color, disabled queers, older queers, younger queers, queer artists, queer activists, queer radicals, you know, queers who are sort of outside, who don't have a place to go. Is it our space? And our answer, you know, it was answered pretty quickly for us, because when we arrived at our center, you know, the cops were there to block us from going inside. And when Gavin Newsom arrived, he was escorted inside by this phalanx of San Francisco Police Department solidarity. And as soon as he got inside, the cops started beating us up. So we had the spectacle, you know, in 2003 in San Francisco, you know, arguably the gayest of American overpriced cities, of the cops beating peaceful queer demonstrators. So several of us were thrown face first into oncoming traffic. One person passed out due to a police chokehold. And one person had their tooth shattered by a police baton, blood dripping down their face. And as this was happening, center staff stood there and watched and did nothing to intervene. So, we can see the way that gay assimilationists have succeeded in clamping down on the anger, defiance, creativity, and subversion once central to and thriving in queer subcultures. In order to promote what we see now on TV, you know, what we see in the gay papers, what we see on cable, what we see in the movies, this whole vapid consume or die, we're just like you. That whole mentality. And obviously, that serves gay people with power. But what is heartbreaking and infuriating is the way that so many others follow along like zombies. So I'll give a couple more examples from San Francisco. Just after the election, Gavin Newsom had this wonderful charade that we're all familiar with now. You know, he legalized gay marriage. And this was this, you know, this blatant, you know, give back to the powerful gay constituency who had gotten Gavin Newsom elected in the first place. And nothing could be less controversial in San Francisco than gay marriage. His popularity soared, you know, as soon as this happened, his popularity soared from just barely 50% to like 70, 80%. And Tim Redmond, the editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian, the progressive weekly newspaper, Tim Redmond, who comes out of the 60s and has made his whole career on critiquing a political spoilage. What does he say about this obvious, you know, give back, you know, to a powerful constituency? He calls it a revolutionary gesture. So this is someone coming out of the 60s, calling Gavin Newsom's, you know, political pandering a revolutionary gesture. And I wrote an op-ed, you know, in response talking about that wonderful revolutionary gesture. And soon thereafter, this new newspaper in San Francisco asked me to write an op-ed. It's called Fault Lines. It's published by SF Indie Bay, the indie media for San Francisco. And they had read the op-ed in The Guardian. They were like, oh, this is great. This is really exciting. We love it. You know, if you can write something this persuasive, you know, about assimilation, that would just be great. But they said, well, they looked at it. They said, well, could you maybe tone down, though, that argument about marriage abolition, right? Because, like, you know, we don't want to alienate our audience. And they specified who their audience is. You know, it's radical and progressive San Franciscans. And, you know, this is sort of evidence, another example of the way the straight and gay left have capitulated to this whole media myth that there are only two sides to this whole gay marriage assimilation debate, right? So on one side, we have these rabid gay assimilationists, right? And who are just thinking, you know, gay marriage, you know, it's the best thing since Will and Grace. And then on the other side, you know, we have these foaming at the mouth Christian right fundamentalists who think that gay marriage marks the end of Western civilization. And, you know, queers who oppose marriage are always shut out of that picture, you know, since we expose that gay marriage assimilation agenda as a grab for privilege, not a civil rights struggle. So, radical queers, we don't want assimilation, you know, into this imperialist, bloodthirsty status quo, you know. We don't want to drape ourselves in the American flag as the U.S. bombs Iraq, overthrows the only democratically elected government in the history of Haiti, you know, makes the whole world safe for any multinational corporation to plunder indigenous resources, funds the Israeli war on the Palestinians. You know, we don't want to drape ourselves in that bloody flag. What do we want? You know, we want to transform gender, revolutionize sexuality, build community and family outside of traditional models, expose and defeat capitalist tyranny, and dismantle all hierarchies of race, class, gender, sexuality, and ability.
Here, here.
So, something like marriage abolition, that is only the beginning. So, this anthology, That's Revolting, which I edited, it's 31 different pieces by 37 authors. Several of them are written collaboratively, and it's a really, really wide range of topics. You know, it covers a whole wide range. I'll talk about a few of the pieces, and then we have two of the contributors to share their work. And then afterwards, we'll have plenty of time for, since, you know, this room isn't owned by Whole Foods, we don't have to leave early. Plenty of time for questions and comments, you know, controversy. So let's see, one of the first piece actually in the book is called Dr. Laura, Sit on My Face. And it's sort of an incantation, you know, to Dr. Laura, and it says, you know, it's by Rocco Bulldagger. And Rocco says, you know, thank you, Dr. Laura, you know, every time I see you, I see your righteous indignation, you know. I just get all hot, you know. And Dr. Laura, you know, I know about your secret desires, your deepest needs, you know, your wants. And Dr. Laura, please just sit on my face. So that's sort of the incantation that begins the book. Then there's a piece by Tommy Avicoli Mecca, and he talks about 3 decades of doing radical queer organizing. So he starts in Philadelphia in the early 70s, organizing against racist carding policies in gay bars. And then he talks about fighting for space for gay public sex in Philadelphia. And then he moves to San Francisco in the early 90s and talks about fighting for the queer youth shelter. And his conclusion of, you know, from the 3 decades of organizing is it's the failure of this mainstream, you know, gay movement to address issues of class that allows for something like, you know, community property values. You know, how can you talk about that if, you know, real issues about racial and class injustice were actually addressed? Let's see. Then there's a piece which is a conversation. It's called Gay Art Guerrillas. And it's a conversation between Sarah Schulman, Jim Hubbard, and Stephen Kent Jusick. And they're talking about downtown New York in the 80s, 20 years of sort of community building and creating art in downtown New York, and the disappearance of that whole culture. And this piece is amazing because Sarah Schulman in particular, in just 1 or 2 sentences, just like destroys cultural icons, just like that. So, you know, to really appreciate a read, you know, you've got to read Sarah Schulman's piece. Because she just, you know, very understatedly will just, she's just like, oh, you know, by the way, Jenny Livingston, you know, who directed Paris is Burning, she's like, oh, when she was kicking out these two people who, you know, had tuberculosis and were dying of AIDS, well, that was before they died. Well, anyway, you know, blah, 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 blah. So it's great. There's a piece called Is Gay Marriage Racist? And this is a conversation by 3 people. Marlon Bailey, Priya Kandaswamy, and Maddie Udora Richardson. And it started after they did a presentation of the same name, and at the end of the presentation, they were able to answer all these really practical questions about gay marriage that people always ask without backing down from their politics at all. And so they sort of recreated that piece for the book. And then there are a bunch of pieces that sort of question, you know, sort of radical queer organizing, whether radical queer organizing doesn't take on some of the same dominant ideologies of mainstream gay organizing. And so there's a lot, you know, the book, as much as about sort of radical queer organizing, is also about critiquing radical queer organizing. You know, I didn't want to present this monolithic picture of what it means to be radical and queer to replace this monolithic, you know, gay identity, you know, about like buying the right products, you know, the right body, the right, you know, lover, the right house, the right dog, the right adopted child, you know, all that stuff. I didn't want to, you know, create another model, you know, that problematic. And so there's a lot of conversation in the book about these kinds of issues and critiquing radical queer organizing. You know, I wanted to sort of bring the conversations that queer organizers have, you know, into a more public domain and talk about queer lives and queer politics in a more complicated interesting and critical way. And there's several pieces that talk specifically about radical queer organizing. There's this piece about Fierce, which is organizing queer youth of color in downtown New York, like organizing for queer public space in New York that's being removed. I write a piece about gay shame, which is sort of a history of gay shame and its transition from starting, you know, to create a radical alternative to pride and moving into this direct action extravaganza that takes on all hypocrites. And my piece, you know, in a lot of ways is about sort of entering queer, radical queer struggles into history before they're erased, you know, because so often the work that we do, the conversations we have, the activism we engage in, even if, you know, one day maybe it makes, you know, a quick little headline in the news, and then the next day it's gone. And I could be having a conversation with people who are basically, you know, similar age, similar background, involved in similar types of activism, and I could be talking about something that happened like 5 years ago, and no one will have any idea what I'm talking about. And it could be something that to me was really formative to my life, you know, formative to my politics, formative to my identity, formative to the way I see the world. And so that's what this book is about in a lot of senses, is sort of entering radical queer struggles into history on our own terms.
That was Matilda, editor of That's Revolting, Queer Strategies for Resisting Assimilation, speaking at Bookshop Santa Cruz on February 3rd, 2005. My name is Bradley, and thanks for listening.